myself and the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Resources, and we are discussing today, or are doing a work session today on House Bill 5059. Which is the Department of Human Resources rebalance. So, I believe we were... Oh, we're in a public hearing. Not working.
Madam Chair, members of the CID, I'm Jerry Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Resources, and with me is Doug Rosen. Had left off with the committee yesterday on senior and disabled services, that portion of the rebalance, so we'll pick up... On OMAP, first page.
Okay, it's the last page, or second from the last page in the handout. I'm Jeremy, Doug Wilson, Director of Program and Finance for the Department. Again, I'm going through the major issues in the handout that should be in front of you, starting with OMAP. The first major issue there is the amount of savings the amount of extra cost, the fee for service area of the health plan. There are two major drivers to what is essentially almost a $9 million general fund problem here. The first one deals with, we have some areas of the state, specifically around the coast, that had some plans pulled out of in terms of service, and so the managed care expenditure is not there anymore, and we must cover those folks through fee for service. And the second major problem with managed care deals with just an ongoing problem we and other health plans and other health providers across the country have, and that is increasing pharmaceutical costs, and we have trouble keeping up with the projections on pharmaceutical costs. So both are major issues for fee-for-service.
Doug, where are you?
We have a handout that looks on the front. It might be a notebook. Yeah, on the second from the last page. Where it should say OMAP at the top, Office of Medical Assistance.
Okay.
The second issue deals with some savings, and I had just said in the fee-for-service side we have increased costs due to some plans leaving, not serving specific areas of state. That does give us some savings. We have increased fee-for-service costs, but we have savings on the managed care side, and the managed care savings in that area are $3.2 million general fund. One thing that's been happening over the later half of this biennium is overall we've had decreasing caseloads in the Oregon Health Plan. Please keep in mind a large share of the health plan's clients are also clients in other divisions. So what may be an increase or decrease in SDSD or AFS also affects the health plan. And overall, in the health plan, we are now forecasting across the biennium 5,300 fewer cases than we had originally or in the last rebalance forecast, and that provides us with about $6.3 million worth of savings. And those populations that are decreasing more than any of the others include the children, the PLM children below the poverty level, 100% of the poverty level,
PLM,
poverty level medical, thank you. The families and the adults couples groups, those three groups are the ones that make up the bulk of those 5,300 fewer cases. And those caseload savings also, as with many of these other caseload and cost per case issues, translate into savings in our forecasts in the reshoot or repricing of the governor's budget that you will be seeing during work session. The next major issue is some savings in the health plan's capitation rates. We have more months of actual data to base these on as we move through the biennium. We continue to take a look at risk adjustment factors, as well as figuring in folks that come in part of the way through the month. And all that together, as issues have reduced the capitation rate, changes by about $2.5 million general fund. And finally, in terms of savings, in the health plan, we took a further look as we were preparing this and next year's reshoot budget here in the past few months, took a look at total expenditures and how much we are tracking along with those, and we identified another $2.8 million of general fund reductions there. Those are the savings and the issues in the health plan. One final issue is associated with the health plan, but mainly is of family planning adjustment that we tend to make about once a year. It takes a programming change to make. Those programming resources were not available mainly because of the Y2K issue. So those savings, which we estimate to be about $3.7 million, will actually happen in the next budget instead of this budget. The next issue is with the CHIPS program. We find that we can save about $1.75 million of tobacco funds, and that's due to fewer cases in the CHIPS program, mainly because of the delay in the startup of that program throughout the biennium, shifts in the capitation rates in different areas.
And Chair. Okay, so we have savings. It's actually federal funds, so we are able then to move that money someplace else and use it someplace else?
Well, actually, the 1.75 in the CHIPS program is tobacco fund savings.
Okay.
The CHIPS program is funded with tobacco taxes, the state share, and then it matches the federal funds.
Okay, and so we had fewer CHIPS cases than we anticipated.
Right.
And so that saved that much in tobacco.
Right.
Okay.
Fewer cases along with taking a look at the other cost factors of the CHIPS program.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Minister. Do you have some sort of a quantity in the fewer cases in that program?
Let's make sure I have it in here. I may have to get back to you on that. I don't have it right in front of me. I do have a graph that would probably show up, and I'm not sure if I can get the actual number of cases out there.
Okay.
It isn't very much. And actually, we still plan to meet our, I think it's about 16,000 cases by the end of the biennium. We're just not getting up to that point as fast as we are. So over the length of the biennium, your savings and in those.
Okay. So this is not a admission that there are fewer kids that have this need. It's just a matter of how quick you're getting the program.
Right, getting up to the level. We had started the CHIPS program, Madam Chair, Representative Kobach, a little later than we originally thought we were going to.
And I would say that at a conference that I was at, there was a discussion among states that other states also have not been able to enroll the number of children that they thought they would. It's really kind of getting the word out and telling people that it is available and that they can take advantage of it.
Well, Madam Chair, I would just observe that it's interesting, you know, in my professional life where we've done a number of programs that youth care, for example, the low-cost insurance program just for kids and things like that. We always hear about this great need of uninsured children, and as soon as we put a program out there, sometimes it starts and then it tails off and doesn't nearly go to the projections. So sometimes you wonder either where these children are or if there are people who are actually, concerned enough to get them into these programs or, you know, where are they and what's happening to them.
Or, and I'll be the bad guy here, or whether for using an emotional issue, saying that there are more children that need it than don't. That may be the case too. Although there is another issue that sometimes people feel uncomfortable having their children on one plan and being on another plan. There's also some dissonance with that. Now, I don't know all of the ramifications, but sometimes it's interesting to know that when you have a new program, you have to beat the bushes to get people to come and take.
And actually, Madam Chair, Representative Strobeck, keep in mind that on the CHIP program, if they are eligible for Medicaid, if you find that they're eligible for Medicaid, they automatically become eligible for the Medicaid portion of our program, not the CHIP program. And we actually do have a slight increase in the PLM over 100%, the poverty level medical kids over 100% in our caseload projection. So there is some of that balancing between those programs. And that requirement is a federal requirement. Continuing, Madam Chair, the second from the bottom issue in OMAP there, we run a number of programs that aren't part of the health plan or the CHIP program. Those include the medically needy program, the Medicare Part B buy-in program, and what is essentially called Indies and Slimbies. But there are certain population groups, and overall, in those non-health plan programs, there's savings of about $1.8 million general fund. And then finally, the last issue here, in one of our, in our plan to tie together the rebalance and the repricing or reshoot of the governor's budget, since we had savings in this rebalance for this current biennium, we tried to identify where we could move funds forward to solve issues next biennium. And that last issue under OMAP is related to that, where we are proposing to use $3.5 million of general fund this biennium and then make available more tobacco tax next biennium. And I believe your staff will have some comments about that when we get to that portion of this today's meeting. And then the last area is department-wide support services, and then I will ask Mr. Cuddy to come forward to talk about the Y2K issue included in this rebalance, but there are a few issues here. Prior to that, we have some over expenditures of about $700,000 in our volunteer program and other areas of our administrative area. Part of this is due to increasing rents. Part of it is due to decreased revenues from the Oregon Youth Authority and some other areas in the volunteer program and administrative areas. And secondly, another big issue in OIS totaling, or two issues in OIS totaling about $700,000 also are the purchase. We need to upgrade our computer transmission lines. These are leased lines, I believe from US West, that we use to transmit data between our field offices and our central office and our mainframes. And those we're upgrading to what we call T1 lines. Basically, we're buying bigger lines that can take care of more capacity. That is one issue there. And the second issue is that OIS has had trouble hiring folks. Not surprisingly, that the state, the amount we can pay at the state level for computer programmers, systems analysts, and those are less than what the private sector or the market out there is offering. And we've had to hire at higher salary ranges than we anticipated or budgeted for, and that represents about a $600 problem, which is part of that $700,000 problem. And just so you understand, I asked the folks at DAS to give me an idea of what the difference is, what our starting area for information systems analysts are, and what the market is bearing is, depending on the class. There are eight different classes of these employees. And many of them, the range that we start those folks off, usually at the state level, is often $5 to $1,000 per month less than what the market is paying right now from the market studies that DAS performs. So it does show that we have to provide a little more to get folks in the door to help us out with a number of information systems issues.
Did you say $5?
$500 to $1,000 per month difference.
Madam Chair. Is that at the top of your range?
Well, we budget, Madam Chair, Representative Loken, near the bottom. That's where we budget. We are having to bring people in closer to the top of the range. In fact, our top of the range is near the mid-range of the market.
Mm-hmm.
So the $500 to $1,000 a month is a pretty substantial amount of money for to compete against.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I would appreciate if Mr. Cuddy would come up, and I'll vacate.
Okay. Madam Chair, just before we lose Doug here, now this is the rebalance for 1999. That's actually just about the rest of this biennium. We're trying to get our budget to come out even at the end and recognize the adds and subtracts that we have as we're trying to finish out our budget. In these areas, are you going to tell us pretty soon in these areas where we've had these reductions in caseload, the changes in projections in OMAP, is that going to be reflected in changes in our projected expenditures in the health plan in the next biennium?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Ross, we have submitted what we call the reshoot plan, for lack of better term, on your staff as well, I think, as a letter to the co-chairs. And as I believe, as we go through work session, those numbers will be updated in the governor's recommended budget.
So are we going to go through this as part of this, or is that a month off, or is that going to be work session?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, normally we would go through the governor's revised request at the time that we're going through the work sessions on the individual divisions, and what they will, what it will appear like is sort of packages, in essence. In other words, it's a package to revise the caseload or to revise the budget for this division based on revised caseload.
Well, maybe I'll get together with you.
It will be when we do the work session based on
the budget. Well, I'll get together with you and we'll talk about what that looks like from the three sheets that's been made.
Yeah.
And we're all very willing to sit down with
you. Thank you. It's hard for me to absorb that in 30 minutes, so I need some preparation ahead of time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
I have a question for your volunteer program.
Uh-huh.
And you show a decrease in revenue from OYA. What kind of revenue do you receive from OYA?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we provide, OYA used to be part of our department until, about 4 years ago, I believe, when they split off from SCF. And we still provide volunteer services to OYA. And at that time, we did a split, and we reviewed this, the mix on the kids we serve between OYA and SCF. And really what the fall in the revenue is due on is we're serving more SCF kids and less OYA kids than we anticipated. And so that revenue isn't coming from OYA. And we will adjust SCF's rates next biennium to reflect that.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair. So, I mean, what kind of revenue do you receive from OYA due to the volunteer program?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we work under an interagency agreement with OYA to provide those services. Some of them are transportation services, some are mentoring services, and we work under an agreement with OYA for them to provide us funds to provide those services. And mainly in terms of volunteer services, they're dealing with we manage the volunteers, we recruit the volunteers, we dispatch the volunteers, for lack of a better term, and those are the services that that OYA is paying for us. We're not paying the volunteers directly, but there's also mileage reimbursement paid to volunteers and a whole host of other
things. Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Mr. Cuddy is here. If you turn to the last page of our handout, it's a portrait instead of landscape. And I just want to go through the, I know there are a number of questions about the other Y2K or the desktop Y2K program by your staff. So we wanted Mr. Cuddy to go through that.
Good afternoon. Again, my name is John Cuddy, and I'm the department's chief information officer. I can just walk through this sheet fairly quickly here for you. You may recall when I talked to you last week about the efforts that we had going on with year 2000 that we have a major undertaking related to our mainframes, and we also have to work on our networks and our desktop PCs and the software that commercial software like WordPerfect or Lotus or something like that that runs on those PCs. We have to work on applications that have developed and developed in our desktop by users themselves. And we have our wide area network, local area network operating systems, and things of that sort. And those we have lumped into, we couldn't come up with a good name. We thought about desktop, and that didn't quite do it. So we call it the other Y2K, which is the non-mainframe part of the Y2K effort. And that is an activity that has been going on now for late last year and is expected to go on until late this year. It is not as big as the mainframe piece of the project, nor is it as complicated or as problematic as the mainframe part, but it still is significant in size. And so we've asked for part of the money that we asked for in our budget package next biennium is to continue the other Y2K part of our effort, and the amounts that you have in front of you for this rebalance are part of that ongoing activity. We have a project office which basically controls the project and is overseeing the deployment of our inventory tool, which I'll mention in a moment a little more, setting up a test lab to check our PCs and software that runs on them for compliance, and is working on our user-developed applications. They are responsible for coordination with our divisions, including business continuation planning, which is not only required by the Department of Administrative Services, but also is something we need to do in case we run into the unexpected around January 1st and something major in the way of social support systems like electricity or telephone networks or something like that gets funny on us. We have to be prepared to react to that and to prepare and plan for continuing our operations as best we can in the event of some emergency of that sort. They also, of course, manage the budget for this activity and report on status. We have to bring our networks into compliance, and this includes our wide area network as well as our local area networks that run in our offices around the state. And in order to do that, we have to buy some hardware, and we need some help from some contractors because the people who normally support our networks are engaged in a lot of them in keeping the networks functioning. This is somebody's liking this to trying to change a tire while you're driving down the freeway, that we have to keep the services going as much as we can that our users rely on, and but at the same time make these changes. And so we need some contract help in the network area to do that. We have, as I mentioned, we need to look at all of our PCs and the software that runs on them. And in order to do that, we are acquiring a automated tool that we've done an RFP for and are going to be using over the next 45 to 60 days to actually go out over our networks and look at every one of our PCs that resides in our networks and tell us about what the PC is and whether or not it's compliant, and also the software that runs on the PC. And we have to pay for that, and that's in this item. And we actually have to do the inventory, acquire the tool and do the inventory. That's covered in the $862,000. And also some of what's in there is the actual work to remediate some of our user-developed applications that run on our desktop machines, on our PCs. So that's in that category as well. And we have some miscellaneous things that we have to do. We have to replace some disks on what are called AS400s, which is an IBM machine, a mid-range machine that's used in our mental health division. We have to buy some disks. We have to upgrade our voice response system. And we also have to do a small amount of work on the client server systems that I mentioned to you, FACES and Access and Trax, to make sure that they are compliant. And finally, we expect, and I would underline the fact that these are estimates. They're the best estimates that we can make at this point in time. But we expect that we're going to need to replace a large number of personal computers in the director's office, including in my own organization. And so we are asking for some money to do that and also to replace software on those PCs.
If I could ask, the tool that you have to check the desktop inventory and all of the things in your network, it's priced in the $862,000?
Madam Chair, yes it is.
Approximately how much is that? That portion of
it? If I can look, I believe, let's see. It's yes, $636,000.
And what is that, a set of a lot of software that goes to different areas, lands, I don't know, whatever, different computers to check? And
Madam Chair, what it is, we have to pay the vendor. We did, as I said, an RFP and a procurement and had a group of bids. And we have to pay the vendor a certain amount per machine, per seat, they call it. And then we also are paying them to provide us with some services to analyze. So the software actually sits here, goes out over the network, goes into a PC, looks at what's on it, records that, brings it back here into a database. And to do that, we're paying this per seat price. and I think it's about $16 a seat. And then there's also some services in there for them to analyze the inventory that comes out of that and help us understand what we need to then go the next step on to fix.
So it's basically just inventorying hardware and software.
Yes. It's on the desktop PCs. Yes, all over the state. And there's, you may recall, there are somewhere around 7,500 to 8,000 of those.
Don't you keep an inventory of your computers and what software is licensed and put on different computers?
Madam Chair, the answer is yes and no. Our divisions have traditionally in DHR, this is a holdover from the time when when information systems was separated by division before OIS, our organization was created. Our divisions traditionally purchased their own PCs and their own software according to their specs and their schedule. And frankly, it's not a well-known item what's out there in each division because these things have been purchased over a series of years.
And nobody's ever kept real track.
Not very well. No. And also the other point I would make as well is that most of the divisional PCs are now compliant as they have moved to the NT operating system, the Windows NT operating system, which is the compliant operating system on the desktop. Most of the PCs in the divisions and some of them in the director's office are now compliant.
Madam Chair, it's more than an inventory, is my understanding. The tool will go out, and let's say I have a database or some system that I developed a couple years ago that may use Gates somewhere in it. It will tell me, that program will tell me where that database has a problem. So it's not going out and saying, here's computer X, here's software package Y. It will also tell me that this database or this program that I created has a Y2K problem inside it. We'll go inside each of those programs, generate it through, and spit out a response.
So it is actually doing something more inside that computer to look at date lines and
right.
Stuff like that.
Yes, I'm sorry, not sure. I didn't make that clear. Yes.
That makes me feel a little better.
And we have, Madam Chair, a number of those programs throughout the department. I mean, many case managers will set up their own little systems for some reason. My budget staff has those systems throughout their computers also.
And, you know, I understand that, you know, if we're bringing all these things together, and because of that, because of the Y2K issue, all of these things are being checked. But I hope that because of this, that brings us to realize that we really need to know what we've got. Even if, I mean, it is a large department, but regardless of that fact, this is not unlike some of the other things I've heard from some other departments that are, because of their size and maybe the diverse things that they do, don't really have a handle on all this.
Now, Madam Chair and members of the committee, if I can offer that we have to do that, but there are a lot of other things we're trying to standardize in this sense. I mean, we purchase all different kinds of equipment now in terms of hardware. We purchase software that's historically been different. We don't even have a single email system in the human resources building itself. We run on at least two and maybe three. I'm not sure we got down to two now. But we started with four email systems. So when I want to send a message to 1,200 people in the building initially, it was a nightmare. And so we're trying to collapse these things over time and develop standards for the purchase hardware, standards for the purchase of software so that we can make sure it all communicates and so on. And that's the goal, or at least one of the goals in the whole business of bringing all the information systems work together now. And so I need to say one other thing. To some extent, even after we have surveyed this and we've taken care of the Y2K problem, there will still be small systems developed by our employees, and we want to encourage that. I mean, if they can develop a small software system that helps them do their job better, we want to encourage that. We want to keep track of what's there. I agree with you on that. But we don't want to discourage them from, small systems on their micro that speed their work and everything.
I understand, and I would agree with that, too. But I think the issue of knowing that it exists and having a standard way of recording what kinds of things are there, so that when a division head leaves or whatever, that information doesn't get lost. That it's, well, we used to know and we used to, but if there's some way that, so I appreciate you trying to, you know, make these things mesh. And it's almost sometimes hard to ask a question because,
well, I think you're going to ask a question.
It's embarrassing.
They're external, even external to the agency, Madam Chair, you know, we're trying to look ahead on that because we've got all these county relationships and private provider relationships, and there's constant demand on John to make our systems match with county systems and stuff. So we have a 5- and 10-year plan with the counties for us to understand what each of us is buying and everything, so we can begin to match those things up outside the department. And that's a big task. But I mean, the benefits are really long term on that.
Well, and I know when we first came to the castle, there were certain specifications in order to be on the system that we had to comply with. Mm-hmm. We had to have this, and this, and this in order to hook up to the system, and that's. I understand a county that's already got hardware and everything, you can't all of a sudden come up with new specifications. But you almost have to let them know in advance of when they might make changes, how they can do that to also link with.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm sure the 5- and 10-year plan that we're trying to lay out is, you know, here's the equipment, kind of equipment we're going to be using. These are the languages we're going to be using, common data definitions if we can get them with the counties and so on. And then everybody on the state side and the county side can have a system that they're working on.
I mean, I know, Madam Chair, when I first came here, I've met with from time to time with county people, and what they would often say is, you know, we're willing to buy what we should have, tell us.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem was, because we had 7 different data processing organizations, which I always, in my sort of smart alecky way, used to say we're going in 8 different directions, we ended up with not being able to give them a DHR standard that they could try to comply with. And many of them said, we're willing if you'll just tell us. And now we're positioned with the centralization to start defining that and be able to tell them, but we're not quite there yet.
Okay, another thing that will help us in the future and won't solve the problem, but help us, is we're going to start taking a closer look at leasing desktop machines. DAS has entered into an agreement with Dell, thank you, and we will, in very competitive rates, where we'll be leasing machines 2- or 3-year leases, and it will also provide service instead of having to rely on self-service, in a sense, in many cases.
Yeah. Is that your aware of stuff?
You know what the trouble I caused at home on my own machine.
Madam Chair, I want to ask a question to see if you can try out your computers before January 1, 2000. I mean, if it doesn't work on year 2000, everything collapses. But is there any way you can try out before that date, have a trial run?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we are very much doing that with our mainframe applications, and we will be testing, as part of our testing of our desktop PCs, we'll be doing just that sort of thing. And that's part of the testing process, is to look ahead with the date and change it and see what happens and make sure that it works properly.
Another question.
In August, we expect to be testing this whole system. We've tried to set this up, John has, with his staff, so that we test at least 3 months before, 3 to 4 months before the end of the year.
Another question.
Okay.
So how do you test it without being on a different date? I mean, in August, how can you put it January 1, 2000?
I'm Chair Senator E. John has all these ways, but you can tell it's your computer. It's not 1999. You say we can set the date for any date we want, and then run the systems against that date, and we'll have a regular test. If it really was that date.
If you have to skip your normal operation in order to get on a different set of dates.
No. No. I mean, you're developing a pilot. You're kind of setting up a database here and saying, okay, today's date is January 1, 2000. You manufacture the date and then run the systems against it as a trial run. That's easy to do. Well, I don't have to do it.
And it doesn't
easy for John to do.
It doesn't interfere with your current operations.
No, ma'am, sure. And the way that John will run this is we'll maintain our current
system. Madam Chair, Senator Yee, what we do on the mainframe, there's several ways to do it. One of the things we can do is set up a special section of the mainframe that we can change and run stuff in as if it were different. Each of these systems has a date function, like on a PC, where you can go in and change the time or the date. Do the same thing. You change the time or the date and change it to 11:58 p.m. December 31st, and wait a few minutes in the case of the PC and turn it back on and then start trying to use it. So we can do that. But yes, that's a good point, and it's something that we are aware of and are testing.
Representative Strobeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. We've heard so much about this issue, and I wanted to know from Mr. Petty, what is the fix that you're doing? Is it a fix that is going to be good for the next 100 years, or is it a 5-year fix, or when you're going back in? I've had some people who are contract programmers tell me that some companies are doing this for like a 30-year fix or a 40-year fix. What are you doing?
Madam Chair and Representative Strobeck, we are doing a technique called windowing, which is not a full expansion of the date. What it does is it makes some assumptions about what dates mean, and the windows will be different lengths. It might be a 30-year fix, where in other words, we assume that any date from 0 to 30 is in the year 2000, and any date from 31 to 99 is in the year 1900. we are doing that. And the reason we did that way is when we first looked at this, again, with 12 million lines of code, we determined it was just too expensive and it would take too long to actually go in there and make a permanent forever fix. And being the perennial optimists that we are, it certainly wasn't true till now, but we have some hope that maybe by the time we run into a later problem with these windows, that many of these systems will have disappeared. But I want to say that's not, I mean, the reason we have this problem is because people thought that.
I made that assumption.
Made that assumption.
So 30 years is the shortest, your shortest fix?
It varies, and I'm not.
Do you know the windows?
I'm not sure. It varies, and it depends on the date and how it's used, the amount of time the length of that window.
Madam Chair, I just observed that this Y2K problem popped up here at the end of the 90s, and I was just hoping that these same, smarter than all the rest of us people who developed the computers in the first place would be able to figure out a way to not have to go back and do this again, unless they were planning on having a continuing job function, basically having a year 10K problem and a year 12 problem and so forth. Mm-hmm. And my other question is this, based on your expertise and professional experience, do you think that electricity will shut down on December 31st?
Madam Chair and Representative Strobeck, everything I read says that is not likely to happen, but I believe as prudent managers we have to plan for the possibility and be prepared in case it does, but everything that I read says that at least particularly in the Northwest, the grid is pretty sound. Not quite so sound, I think, in some other parts of the country, but probably we're okay, so everybody says. Thank you.
You're doing all this work, and I suppose all the other agencies are trying to do this too. Is there any communication between agencies to work this out together, or maybe you're finding something out, and maybe transportation's finding something out, and so on? that could be shared. Are they all based in the same? I suppose they have different kinds of hardware and software to deal with, but is there any way to help one another?
Madam Chair and Representative Logan, there are a number of activities going on to share information. There's a statewide interest group for year 2000 that the Department of Administrative Services chairs and leads that meets frequently. I think it's every other week, if I'm not mistaken, and the major agencies are represented on that, and they share a lot of stuff. We have informal contacts between agencies where we do that. And we have a lot of interfaces with other agencies where we either send them information, or like with DMV or the state police, where we either send information to them or they send us information. And as part of our elaborate testing activity to make sure that these changes are going to work, we test those interfaces, and as part of that, we communicate with them about specific data that gets exchanged between us and make sure that we coordinate that. So there's a lot of that going on. And do they have the same problems? Yeah, and again, it depends in part on the nature of their business. For example, the Department of Corrections, I am told, has had, because of sentencing, has had to look ahead past the January 1st, 2000 for quite a while now. And so they may not have the same problem with some of their dates that we have because of the nature of their work.
Mm-hmm.
So it varies from agency to agency.
But you, you feel that the agencies have profited from this communication and interchange?
Yes, we have. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Does that conclude your?
Yes, I'm sure.
Okay. What we will do then is we're going to open a work session on Hospital 5020 and Peggy, do you want to?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think one of the ways that we could walk through our recommendations, and you may want to start out by asking for DAS's recommendations, but when we get to ours, we would direct your attention to page 10 of our LFO analysis handout.
What's this?
The face of it looks like it's the department.
Mm-hmm.
Not if that page doesn't
see the face.
Says Archer Britton.
Yep. Got it.
It's like a law firm with an Archer Britton.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Page 10 is a summary of our recommendations that we can use and to go down, and then you may want to also keep the agency's presentation document nearby when we talk about a particular division.
Okay. So, did you have some recommendations for this week?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the record.
Yes,
Kelly Creel, Department of Administrative Services. Actually, my comments are very brief. We do support the agency's rebalance plan. Comments really being that this rebalance plan is pretty typical of every other rebalance plan where you're looking at changing circumstances, costs, and caseload changes as a result of that. I guess I would note, and your staff will do the same thing, there really are only one policy issue and one new program. You've already talked about the other Y2K. That's really something that was not in the previous plans, is new to this one. And the other is the policy issue of whether you carry forward other funds or
revert the general fund. So in our review of this plan, there are really only two major issues that come that should probably should be highlighted, and your analysts already have recommendations on both of them. Our concerns are really more how this plan translates into what the legislature ultimately produces as far as the budget for this agency next biennium. I talked a little briefly about how tight this budget is next biennium, and I'll probably continue to talk about that at a later point.
Okay.
So with that, Madam Chair, that's my comment.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions? Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll deal with the Y2K issue, which affects all of the divisions separately at the end. So in terms of adult and family services, aside from the Y2K issue, we're recommending that you approve the rebalance adjustment. Then when as for the State Office for Services to Children and Families, what does not show on the rebalance this time, because it was a rebalance issue in November. In November, there were $3.2 million, 3234121 to be exact, of general fund that was unscheduled. It was savings that were identified at that time, and the emergency board recommended that DAS unschedule those savings, and we are recommending that amount of money be disappropriated. That makes that money available for use when we review this agency's budget as we go through the budget process, as well as other agencies, but it makes it more immediately available for looking at this budget, since you happen to be the subcommittee that knows about it and is most familiar with it. Our second recommendation is that the health division, that you disappropriate $30,000. You'll remember that the rebalance plan had proposed using $30,000 of general funds to continue lead screening in the public health laboratory through the remainder of the current biennium. And we are suggesting that you not do that, not that we're opposed necessarily to lead screening, but this is one of those programs that was started with federal grant money, with the assurance that when the federal grant money goes away, that there won't be any obligation on the part of the state to continue the program. Because Oregon, even though we do probably like every place else have some lead incidence of lead tainting, Oregon is considered to be a state of low incidence of lead contamination, and for that reason the federal government shifted the dollars that they had for lead screening to other states, and that happened in June of 1997. The department chose to use other fees in the public health laboratory, I think newborn screening fees, to maintain the program throughout this biennium. They're suggesting that you use this money from the general fund to continue it for the rest of the biennium, and we're suggesting that you disappropriate that money and not use general fund, or not start using general fund to backfill this program. They are continuing to search for non-state sources or state sources, as the case may be, to support this program. It is not in the governor's recommended budget for 9901.
Madam Chair, is there a minimal public health impact to that?
I believe that the department has found up to, in some of the tests, 5.5% incidence in some areas of contamination.
I don't know.
Some of the tests. I don't know what
that means in terms of.
5.5% of the tests that they've had have had lead contamination. Of when most of those, the vast majority of that is the minimal. I think there is a range. Now, I know nothing about this except that there is a range, and up to 10, you're all right, and beyond 10, you're not as good, and above 20, it's bad. The vast majority of their tests were of the 5.5 that showed contamination were between 10 and 19 on the range. And then the small part were above the 20.
Madam Chair, could I offer something in this conversation with Senator Shield? We chose to continue this program because it's really important to certain parts of communities in this state, particularly in Portland, in the northeast part of Portland, where you have a lot of older homes, and it's largely very culturally diverse neighborhood and stuff, a lot of African-American families, and there's a significant problem in those kinds of neighborhoods with older homes, lead paint being used in many of those homes, and the health hazard to children in those homes who think chips in one way or another, is significant. So I don't want to minimize percentages, the health risks in certain communities, certain parts of communities in the state, and that's why we chose to try to find, as Archer's pointed out, we chose to try to find other ways to continue this program because it was so important in those neighborhoods and to some of those specific populations that we continue the program. And she is correct, Ms. Archer has correctly reported also, it is not in the governor's budget for the next biennium, but we were trying to fulfill a commitment that we started in this biennium for the balance of the current biennium by trying to find money to continue. So it, for some populations and some communities, it's a very big deal.
Mm-hmm. And if there are no more questions on that, I'll go on down the recommendations before you vote, if that's where you want to do that.
Yeah, the intention for the committee, the intention here is that we're going to go down these, the LFO recommendations, and then we'll vote on those recommendations. And of course, if there are questions during this, we'll have those questions answered via staff here. Go ahead.
The next recommendation involves the Senior and Disabled Services Division. In this division, we're recommending that you disappropriate $128,284 general fund that was requested in the rebalance as the current biennium startup of an effort to reduce food stamp error reductions. As I think the agency mentioned in their Doug did when he went through this particular division, they have a high incidence or have had a high incidence of errors in the eligibility, food stamp eligibility area, and they wanted to start up in the current biennium, and then again there is a package, I believe, for $1.2 million in the next biennium that would add staff to help reduce the error rate. And we're suggesting that, first of all, evidence shows that their error rate has begun to come down. And as a hint of work session recommendation to come, we're probably not going to be recommending that package because we assume that the agency, with its existing resources, can take management action to reduce the error rate. And so we recommending that you take that money and disappropriate it and make it available for other uses.
Will the hiring of the internal auditors help to reduce the error rates also?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I don't believe so. The internal auditors are actually going to be looking at broader things than the error rate. And Ms. Archer is correct, the error rate has begun to come down. And I have a regular discussion with the regional food stamp people where they come up and chide us about the error rate, and I tell them I only have so many staff, and I'm going to put my staff probably on moving people from welfare to employment and not checking on the error rate. I mean, that's the fact, because there's far more benefit to us to move people off and to become self-sufficient than to try to work on two or three points on the error rate of the food stamps. Now, it's not saying we don't believe error rates in the food stamp program are important. And we will, if you choose not to fund either the package or this rebalance, we will continue to try to push for improvement in our error rate. But we're going to use our staff in the way that's probably most productive for the state, and that is moving people to self-sufficiency.
Well, let me ask you this, Gary. When somebody comes to take advantage of or they need, however, that's would be stated, food stamps. Does not your staff check to see if they are eligible to receive food stamps?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do. All that's part of the eligibility check. But eligibility of the food stamps is prospective. You come in and we report your effective earnings and so on like that, and we determine whether you're eligible and you have all your expenses. And under the current food stamp rule, this is something that I've testified before people in Congress with that. Under the current food stamp rule, if you then get overtime, shift differential, or anything else, and you come back and report that, then we have an error rate.
Okay.
We have an error rate in our food stamp calculations, and in fact, what happens is what we want to have happen. People have more employment, their wages go up, and any one of us, except for those who work on a salaried basis, could have trouble forecasting our wages that far ahead.
Are your employees telling these recipients of food stamps that when their wages go up, that they should not be utilizing the food stamps, that there is a penalty to the state when they are using it, when they are not eligible?
I'm sure, absolutely. Not only telling them, we provide written materials to food stamp applicants and recipients to say if your situation changes, you must report your situation to us and so on. So it's clear. But people, what I'm saying to you is they don't necessarily do this intentionally. When someone comes on and they're working at Domino's Pizza Parlor and they get an overtime shift, or their wages are increased for any number of reasons, then they come in and report that. We have an error rate. It's a federal error rate.
Okay. You say it's not intentional.
I'm saying, I'm sure, not. I don't think we should assume that in every case people are trying to defraud us, that there are good reasons why an hourly wage person at a minimum wage can't forecast within $5 a month what their wages are going to be.
How do other states control this?
Other states, I'm sure other states have error rates as high or higher than Oregon's. The highest error rate in the country was the state of Washington a year ago. And the governor in the state of Washington made it a priority because my suspicion is for political reasons and maybe others, he didn't want the state of Washington listed as having the highest error rate. So I was just up there a month ago visiting with the staff up there, and they committed a whole lot of people to this, and they're bringing their error rate down. And as Ms. Archer said, our error rate is coming down. We're getting near the national average, which is it runs about 9.6% error rate across the nation. But we do, I think, an aggressive job of determining eligibility, advising people that if their income changes, they have to come in and report. But things happen, particularly with this population. They're the low income, not salaried population that are on food stamps, largely.
So the onus is not on our staff? The onus is on the recipient of food stamps?
I'm sure the onus is on our staff to initially determine whether what they're bringing us causes them to be eligible. And then it's on our staff to continue to check on the validity of the income that's reported to us. But that income can change, I think, for reasonable, under reasonable circumstances.
Senator Steele?
I've heard it.
Okay.
I won't ask any more questions.
Let that be a warning to you.
From above. From above.
Yeah, it was from above.
It was an electrical cord.
Well, it sounded pretty hard.
It was shocking to me. I have heard that the error rate can sometimes generate a fine from the federal government. Are we anywhere close to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, yeah, we're not really close to that. We've been there. But the fine is... the fine is of the nature that you get actually a federal penalty, and you must reinvest your penalty into actions that will reduce your error rate. So when we get a federal penalty, then we draw up a plan to reduce our error rate, and we invest, an amount close to our penalty into that plan.
Can I follow up on
this?
Quickly. Okay. Can you handle it totally within SDSP, or don't you have to help out, excuse me for beating the drum I beat before, but the AAAs, aren't they involved with their underfunded programs and a higher error rate than they might have?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, yeah, in fact, that is where the error rate is the highest. And eligibility for food stamps occurs under the AFS program and under Senior and Disabled Services program. The SDS is done on its own, and then some of it is done by the AAA. We have far less control of the AAA staff around the state determining eligibility for food stamps. And the error rate is higher among the AAAs. I don't believe that's because they take this any less seriously, nor have any less commitment to accurate work. But it just happens.
They are, I understand. Which could contribute.
Senator Shields, Madam Chair, there is a staffing issue on the part of the AAAs.
John, did you have
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I asked that very question. I wanted to see the error rates and how they compared between the state offices and the AAA offices, and I have not received that data. I was told that the data were invalid or not conclusive and that that data would eventually be given to me, but I have not received it yet. So I can't do what Mr. Weeks is saying, but I haven't seen that for a fact.
Madam Chair, these funds that are being recommended are also helping being invested in the AAAs too. We weren't just providing training and follow-up and scrutiny of our own offices.
And if I recall, Doug, what you said, because I wrote it down in my notes, you're going to have temporary employees go teach and train current employees in the field. Sounds a little strange, but anyway.
Well, on this specific issue.
I know. Still sounds strange.
Master, how long do they, question here, how long do they have to project out how much they make when they apply for food stamps? That to tell you, you know, not only how much they made prior to that up to for a length of time, but do they have to project out into the future?
Madam Chair, Senator Fisher, we can go back and check historical earnings just to sort of confirm that the data they give us prospectively makes some sense. But there's a reporting period that's generally every 3 months we're bringing clients in. And one of the things that we've tried to get by the feds and haven't is that if a client has a regular job, we don't want to make them take time off from their regular job to come in and review their income, which we think is fairly stable, you know. So we've tried to get away from that because we get continual complaints from the food stamp recipients that they're taking time off from their job. They don't get paid to come in and sit while we review their income. But it's generally every 3 months that we check, and we would like not to have to do that, frankly. But it's difficult, again, for these kinds of clients who work on an hourly wage for the large part, minimum wage and somewhat above, have the precision in reporting their income that is really called for under food stamp rates now.
Can you follow up on that with modern conveniences like fax machines and things so they don't have to leave their job? Could they report what if they've seen that they have worked overtime or are earning more in over a series of weeks or something? Could they report that?
And I'm sure they can.
Without taking work time off work?
They can come in and they can do that by providing some kind of statement and so on like that, right?
Like a check stub.
Check stubs, those sorts of things. Yeah, that's possible. So we don't want them to take time off work.
Right.
We want them to be at work.
But, like I say, we have all kinds of modern conveniences. And I understand if you use a fax machine at a mailbox place, it costs $350 or something like that. But they would not have to go take off work to come and tell us, and they are getting an entitlement, and we need to have the state employees, make very, very clear to these people that when they are making more, for whatever reason, we want them to. We applaud them for doing that, but at the same time, if they don't report it to us and they continue taking using the food stamps, that we get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And I think we make that abundantly clear, and we'll just continue to reinforce that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, this whole thing reminds me of something that was so frustrating to me when I was in the military and driving the truck. This truck, I could not put down less than a mile between. I had three stops in less than a mile distance. I had to drive around posts sometimes aimlessly to get enough miles to put down a correspond with my speedometer. There was nothing I could do. They made a liar out of me one way or the other. And I see the same identical thing happen here where they've got a set of circumstances. They're accusing the state of having an error rate of something that they have basically absolutely no possible way of doing.
They do have a way.
Well, it's pretty hard what somebody can't, you know, how do you know if you're a waitress making minimum wage and get more tips on that than you get in another month? I mean, they're just...
You know, because you can't.
Well, I understand that you can't predict this, and you can't get a line on it within a $4 or $5 margin. No way.
Okay, Madam Chair. But just quick, you mentioned Gary, $5. Do you have to get within a range of $5? Did I?
Well, Chair, Representative Wilkin, the food stamp rules are very, very tight in this. With within $5, $10, and so on. And the fact, if somebody comes in and reports, let's say they forecasted their income, and then they make more because they worked overtime, they worked a Saturday or something, they come in and report that to us, that's still an error rate. Okay, I don't want to make this a longer conversation than it has to be, but it's still an error rate. So the most honest food stamp recipient who comes in every time they make $5 or $10 more than they reported still costs us an error rate.
I said we write a letter to our congressman.
Well, I'm sure that would be helpful. The food stamp program is being reauthorized here in another year or so, and we're spending a lot of time looking at that. And someday we have a longer conversation, and we can tell you several other places in the food stamp program where we could
make the rules better. Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Brock.
So if I understand this correctly, that the only improvement in the error rate is actually people predicting what they're going to do the next month. If they come in and say, I'm going to have overtime next month, and so I think I'm going to be working 2 weekends, so I think my income will be more this month. That's the only way you reduce your error rate. You can't reduce your error rate by them telling you that boss calling in this weekend, they call on Monday and say, I work this weekend. That doesn't help you.
I'm sure Representative Ross, yeah, that's correct, because they've already given us an income figure. And so we have to do the best we can by counseling them at the beginning, you know, try to think about the overtime that you've historically gotten, and how much you earned, and then put that into your forecast. So
Madam Chair, is it an error rate if they don't make as much as they forecast?
Madam Chair, Representative Loken, yeah, that can be an error rate. They've under forecast. But the only person penalized is the client, because the client didn't get food stamps open.
But you're not. Your department's not.
I don't believe we are, Representative Wilkin. I mean, I'd
be pretty ridiculous.
I don't believe we are, but I'd need to confirm that.
Okay. Madam Chair, just to continue, the reason for that, our recommendation is that we believe that they can continue to do whatever it is they're doing that has brought their rate down to about the national average without the additional dollars. The second part of our recommendation concerning the Senior and Disabled Services Division is another recommendation to disappropriate general fund dollars and make them available for use in the 9901 budget. That is a disappropriation of $2,846,863. This is, you'll recall, the agency had proposed that they spend general fund in the current biennium that they had identified as savings, and that they carry over into the 9901 biennium other funds, primarily from estate recoveries and other revenue resources that come to the Senior and Disabled Services Division. If I were the agency, I would make this request, because what this does is say that when those funds carry over, they are dedicated to the programs in the Senior and Disabled Services Division, and so they are assured of being there for those programs. But not being the agency and looking for maximum flexibility for the for the legislature, and also knowing that within this budget there will be needs outside of the Senior and Disabled Services Division that you may want to weigh against those needs. We're recommending that you disappropriate those dollars so that the general fund will be available for looking at all of your options, not just a more narrow focus. Okay. They still will carry over, and at the same time, the second part of that recommendation is that you increase their other fund limitation so that they can spend their estate recovery.
Madam Chair, does that mean you give them the limitation without the money to spend?
No, they have the money. Mm-hmm. What they want to do is save the other fund's money from estate recoveries and have that carry forward to spend in the 9901 budget. And in order to have that money available to carry forward, they want to spend more general fund in the current biennium, which they have identified as savings in the current biennium. And so what they're saying is, we've identified these savings, and we want to spend these general fund dollars in the current biennium, and in so doing, that will free up other funds that we don't have to spend, and because they're dedicated to our agency and to this program, we can carry those forward into 9901, secure in the knowledge that they will be here. Our recommendation says that if you don't approve that, then the general funds and disappropriate the general funds, that you may place them there if that's where you want to place them, but you may also choose to place them someplace else. It gives the legislature the flexibility to choose where to use the dollars. Mm-hmm.
And mentioned.
Representative Brown.
Does this then create a hole in their budget because their budget was built on the idea of having these funds carry over?
It can create a hole. In this particular case, it doesn't, because these $2.8 million were all identified, and John can correct me if I'm wrong, as enhancements in the reshoot, namely the enhancement for food stamp error reduction. And what were the other? There was a backfill of client-employed provider payments for spouses that are not allowed, but backfilling the general fund. But, John, why don't you go over the three elements that make up these dollars?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Peggy's right. Of the 2.8, 1.2 was the related to the food stamp error rate. $0.8 million was related to a spousal payment, which is for in-home providers. This program allows spouses to provide necessary services, but the problem with it is that Medicaid, it's not a Medicaid program. Medicaid rules don't allow it to be reimbursable through Medicaid. The $800,000, as I understand it, is the amount of general fund that would be required to fully fund that program in the 9901 biennium.
Mm-hmm.
The third piece of it is that the AAAs undertake certain activities in their casework that are also not Medicaid reimbursable. I asked FDSC about what those activities were, and they said they didn't know, but they would have that information for me by May 7th.
And how much is that third item? How much?
The AAA.
It's about another $800,000.
Okay. Thank you.
Roughly.
Thank you. That's helpful.
And our, Madam Chair and members of the committee, our recommendation, again, does not preclude you when we go through the work sessions from saying that you want to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
It simply gives you the flexibility that...
It's a more conscious decision.
Right. It's much more of a conscious decision.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The next recommendation we have is very similar to the one that we just had, and that is in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, where through caseload reductions and the net effects of caseload and costs primarily, there have been identified the savings in the general fund. The agency has proposed that they use these general fund savings and in place of tobacco tax revenues that are currently spent on the health plan, and that they carry forward the tobacco tax revenue into the 9901 budget. Again, tobacco tax revenues are dedicated to the health plan, and so if they carry forward into the 9901 budget as tobacco tax, then they're spent on the health plan. And we're not saying that that isn't the way you want to spend them or the way that you shouldn't spend them, at least some of them, although I think in the 9901 budget, these caseload trends tend to carry forward, and so those savings would probably be spent elsewhere, probably in mental health or someplace else in the reshoot. But the subject is the same. If you if you don't allow them to do that fund shift that they've requested, and they go ahead and spend the tobacco tax money in the current biennium, and you disappropriate the general fund, you have the flexibility to use that general fund as weighed against other options. The second part of that is a little bit, if that has been convoluted, this gets a little bit even more so, because this is also tobacco tax money, but there were three areas in the rebalance where they showed savings in the CHIP program related to tobacco tax expenditures that they were not going to have. One was the caseload area, and by the way, the answer to your question, Representative Strobeck, is 983 fewer CHIP eligible. There were savings there, about $333,000 in tobacco tax revenue, and we're not making any suggestion that you take those, because those caseloads are fluctuating, the program is still growing, and we're suggesting that you let those funds carry over. But the other two areas, one was a $40,000 area and the other a $1.4 million area, we're suggesting that you take those tobacco tax revenues. Again, tobacco tax revenues are dedicated to the health plan, and the CHIP is part of the health plan. If you take those tobacco tax revenues and use them on the health plan Medicaid program, where you know that you have caseload and expenditures in the current biennium, and that in so doing you free up another $1.4 million of general fund money in the Medicaid portion of the health plan, which you could disappropriate and add to your pool of money that you have to look at all of your options and all of the holes that may occur in the agency's budget. And so that's that total disappropriation in the OMAP budget would be $4,951,559. And then we would recommend that you likewise increase their other funds expenditure limitation so that they can spend those tobacco tax dollars.
Would you say that number again?
It's a 4951559. It's right there in the second bullet.
Oh, right. Okay. Excuse me. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, are these general fund money needed for matching funds?
The general fund and the tobacco tax both match federal funds.
So when you reduce the general fund, then does it reduce the federal matching funds?
No, because you're reducing the general fund and you're spending tobacco tax, and tobacco tax is used to match the federal funds. So it's not, you're not losing the federal funds because you're matching them with tobacco tax dollars instead of general fund dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't any change as far as the federal funds are concerned.
Well, we have enough tobacco tax money to make up for the taking away of general funds.
Yes. Their original proposal was that they save the tobacco tax and move it forward and spend it next biennium. We're suggesting that they don't do that, that they stay with their current budget and spend those tobacco tax dollars and take the savings of the general fund they've identified, and we will disappropriate those so that they're available for use in the 9901 budget. So they spend the same amount of money in the current biennium that they otherwise would. They just spend it from tobacco taxes, which is the way their current budget would show it.
Mm-hmm. Another question. So the general fund we save, do we use it for this biennium for next biennium.
We use it. For, you would be using that for next biennium.
For next biennium. Mm-hmm. I see.
And when we go through the agency's work sessions, which will be starting soon, they will undoubtedly show you places where they think it ought to be spent.
Well, Madam Chair, it's important to understand as you corral the general fund so that you can use it at your discretion and you drive us to spend the tobacco tax and other funds, then there's, I have to say again, there's $11 million that's not in the next biennium budget. It's unbalanced by $11 million. And I understand that you would have the discretion to put it back. But
you don't trust us.
No, no. I'm sure I have infinite trust that you'll make the right decision.
Yeah. Sometimes we'll make the right
decision. I think we understand. Thank you.
The last part of our recommendation has to do with the Y2K issues that have been discussed. And what we have done is, as we've gone through and looked at all of those assessments to the different divisions that relate to the purchase of the desktop computers and software and the independent sort of non-mainframe programs that need to be upgraded, and the $2 million for the tool and the assessment that was discussed. And we're recommending that, not that these not be in their budget and they not have the expenditure limitation and the general fund, but that you ask DAS to unschedule those dollars for a short time, pending a few sessions that we might have with DAS's, with the Department of Administrative Services Information Management and Resource Division, so that we have an opportunity to get a written assessment from that division on their feeling about the appropriateness of this approach and this tool, and that we be able to review the plan with Representative Hill, who's chairs the House Information Management Technology Committee and has a particular interest in reviewing this. We're not necessarily suggesting, and this would be at the pleasure of the committee, that we bring this back, but that we review it with those parties, and when we have written response, we can forward that to you, or you could have the committee come back, the agency come back one way or the other.
Yes.
But we feel that we need to have a closer look at this methodology before actually releasing the dollars. Senator Fields, you had a question.
Well, my question is back earlier, as I was listening to Gary, and I think Doug is going to respond to Peggy's comment. It just seemed like there were two different routes to get to the same destination, and I still don't understand the significance of the difference. Is their route safer in getting to the goal or not? I'm just confused in that back and forth.
Are you talking about, Senator Shields, are you talking about the dollar shifts or what?
The unscheduling of the 4-9 in tobacco money versus the 4-9 in general fund that you guys are talking about. I did not follow which way is safer. I hear Gary saying we trust you, the committee. I just didn't understand. It sounded like you're both trying to get to the same ends, and I don't.
Let me say this, and then you correct anything that I either don't get or if I get wrong. The agency, when they came forward with their budget and their rebalance, they told us several times, this is very close, and, you know, we're budgeted very tight. And I think Kelly told us that from GAS. I say all that to say that they have this money, these general funds pigeonholed for certain things, and what our staff is saying is that we're disappropriating some of those general funds so that if this committee should decide that we don't want to use them in that way, we have more flexibility within this budget to use it. But That is not to say that we are planning on doing it any differently. And that's why you feel you're hearing sort of a safety issue, I think, and that's why I said you don't trust us, because it does give a little more flexibility. Now, did I say that?
No, ma'am, I'm sure you said it right. I think, just to reiterate, in the rebalance process, these dollars were identified as current biennium savings, the general fund dollars. The current biennium budget would have them spend tobacco tax dollars. What they're saying is, we would rather not spend our tobacco tax dollars. We would rather spend these savings we've identified, because as we carry over the tobacco tax dollars, we know where they're going to be spent. And as I said earlier, if I were in their shoes, I would probably do the same thing, but that does not give the legislature the maximum flexibility in how they, or you, might want to spend those dollars. Their current plan would have them spend tobacco tax dollars, and we're just suggesting that they stick in these cases with the current plan. The adjustment to that, the exception to that, however, is the $1.4 million. That is tobacco tax money that they have identified as savings, and they would not spend that in the current biennium. They would carry that forward to spend it on the CHIP program, probably, in the next biennium. And actually, that's not even so sure that they would spend it on the CHIP program, because the information given indicated that, their CHIP program is fully funded in the governor's recommended budget at the target level. Their caseloads are not likely to exceed that level. So this CHIP money, as tobacco tax, would be available only for one other purpose, and that would be for the health plan. By backfilling that in the current biennium and freeing up general fund in the Medicaid program, that just gives you another $1.4 million of general fund so that you can decide what you would like to do with it.
Therefore, if I might, the conclusion is that the most fanatic defenders of the Oregon Health Plan among us would probably prefer their methodology to the one that you are suggesting.
That could be, although I would not want to characterize anyone who voted against this as not a fanatic defender of the health plan.
But my conclusion, I think, is a logical conclusion based on the fact that if you carry the tobacco tax money forward, it's pretty much locked in to being in the health plan. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, that's correct. And we believe that when you see the 9901 budget, you may find that there are other areas that may come forward as options for use of money. And that is the end of our recommendations. Otherwise, I didn't mention mental health, because we recommend approval of their plan. And anything else that is in the plan, we're recommending approval with the exception of these items here.
Okay. Now, the way I'd like to handle this is for the committee to act on what we have been given as options here, but we're going to wait on finishing the entire bill or moving the entire bill out of here, because we still want to get an answer on the upper limit Medicaid or the Medicaid upper limit program that deals with the public nursing homes and so forth. For this bill is a vehicle for monies in this biennium for that. So
Monday,
I think we're gonna try to do that Monday. So
okay.
We're just waiting for some further information. Well,
sure. Is the chart the summary of what you recommended here, or this chart is something else?
Madam Chair, Senator, you know the chart is something else. The chart shows you the amounts of money in the budget, spread throughout the budget, that are earmarked for this Y2K non-mainframe needs that John Cuddy described. And what we're saying is that these would still remain in the budget. I'm simply showing you in the chart where they are, but the proposal then says that DAS would would temporarily unschedule the $1.1 million general fund, the $4.5 million other funds, the $998,000 federal funds, until we have something in writing from DAS IRMD indicating that they believe that this is the appropriate tool to use and methodology to use, and we've had a chance to let Representative Hill review that as well.
Mm-hmm. Another question, Madam Chair.
Sorry.
So why is the total $6.6 million when what they need is only $2 million?
Madam Chair, that is the cost as it appears in the director's office budget, that there are assessments that take place. So there's a double counting of costs all the time. And you'll see, for instance, when you look down at the director's office,
mm-hmm.
there's $2.4 million there. All of those monies come from these other assessments that are.
So the total project is $6.6 million.
And this total of what we're recommending be unscheduled temporarily. Yes, and we're not recommending that this be a long-term thing. We're talking about something that obviously there are only less than 2 months left. So we're suggesting that this be something that we facilitate resolving this week.
Kelly?
Madam Chair, we certainly don't disagree with what Ms. Archer is saying about unscheduling the resources. I think we would just like the record to be very clear that the department hasn't just gone out and done this other Y2K without our oversight. We sat down with them and went through the assumptions that they were using to develop these costs and actually reduce the costs as a result of that. I think we all recognize there are some elements of that cost that are still uncertain. And so we understand the need to make the cost or make sure we have the cost uncertain. But there has been a review already, and we'll continue to watch the process.
Which makes it even actually more feasible to do this because you've looked and it's.
Madam Chair, that's why we would not have any problem with unscheduling the resources.
Madam Chair, we will have to. We're not going to slow down our process here, and that makes this that much more important to do it on a quick time frame because we need to solve these problems because the dates.
It's
a problem. And IRMD is taking a look at this Testmasters, which is the statewide oversight contractor hired by DAS, has also reviewed these other Y2K issues. So this has been reviewed significantly.
Okay.
You need a motion?
I do.
As Chair, I move that we accept the LFO recommendations on the DHR rebalance. That's sufficient.
Representative Throwback moves the LFO recommendations and the proposal by DHR for the rebalance with these changes to the LFO recommendations. Is there a discussion?
I'll be a no vote because we are creating a hole in the upcoming budget, and I have a concern about this kind of action creating a disincentive for the department to save money. That if they save money, if they work hard to save money and to be accurate in their projections, and then we come along and scoop this money up and take it away from them, then we create an incentive for the agency to hide the money, not to save it. And so I have a concern about that, and that's a concern I have. I hope we will, when we go back, I hope we'll look carefully and make conscious decisions about refilling these holes. Some of them we may not want to do, and some of them we may want to, and I have some secret places I'd like to put money to.
But we're not going to let you because you're voting no on that.
Well, that's what I'm worried about. That's why I'm worried about that.
You won't be able to have any say in any of this money.
I have a fear of retaliation because of my vote here, but at the same time, I understand that the chair is very fair and is also concerned about the welfare of the agency.
Absolutely.
And so that what I am hoping is that we'll make conscious decisions about refilling these holes when the time comes.
Well, I thank you. I would hope that we're making some conscious decisions as well, and this is not a disincentive to save money and scoop up money for other things.
but it is true. You will not have anything to do with any of this money that's spent.
I've said enough about my concern that we go ahead and spend the general fund and save the tobacco money, the 4.9. And so I guess I'm a no vote. But I also want to express concern about the 30,000 in the health division, because I think it's disproportionately hits the poor and the minorities that have the old homes in the inner city that have the lead paint. And that's something I just wanted to go on record. So I guess I hate to do it, but I'll be a no vote on this particular method of getting through the rebound.
I really would like to get more information on this proposal. But the chair needs a vote to get it out of committee.
Well, we're not moving it out of committee.
Oh, okay.
We're going to move the full bill. We're going to act on the bill on Sunday with regard to the upper limit, the Medicaid upper limit program. However, what we're acting on right now is this.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to revisit this once we pass it. And I just need to know if this is something that you don't agree with, we're going to have to take a recess. And so I just need to know that.
Mm-hmm. I'll support the proposal.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
And I understand Cisco Analyst has a lot of knowledge, and I'm depending on her knowledge and her recommendations. But I will still continue to do more research on this.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think actually that what you'll find, Senator, is that with your research, you will find that our staff has done an excellent job, as has the Department of Human Resources. This will allow us to actually make some good decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So let the record show them that Representative Ross and Senator Shields are no votes on the LFO recommendations, and they have passed, and we will revisit this on Monday.
Yes, we'll come forward, and on Monday we have scheduled this again. Tomorrow we have public testimony on the health plan. Thursday we have public testimony on alcohol and drugs. And Monday we have then the nursing home. I lost my crib sheet there. The Medicaid upper limit program. The agency will come back and talk a little bit about that at the beginning of the hearing. And we'll propose some wording that would be inserted in House Bill 5059, which is this rebalance bill, that would make it possible for them to have the expenditure limitation that they need in the current biennium to affect that. We won't be talking about what ultimately will happen with it, but only so that the mechanics.
Okay. With that, we will adjourn.